This is London calling North America. The British Broadcasting Corporation presents London Letter. This week, MacDonald Hastings talks about the Arctic conditions we're experiencing here in Britain and about two things which are interesting many of us in brief moments when we're not worrying about the cold.
This is MacDonald Hastings. I hope I sound as chilly as here in London we're all feeling.
As I'm talking to you, this part of the world is nearly as cold as Canada.
No, it's much colder, because folk in Canada, realizing they live in a cold country, take sensible precautions to keep themselves comfortable in the long and dreary winter. Not in England. Here in London, where the old chronicles were recording memorably cold winters as long ago as 1150, and where it's a matter of historical record that since February 1684, the Thames has periodically frozen solid to a depth of 6 feet from bank to bank for 6 miles, here in London, I'm ashamed to admit that we still organize our lives and build our houses as if a really cold snap in the weather were the most surprising thing in the world. Nearly every year, about this time in our climate, not at Christmas, snow at Christmas in England was only the invention of a fiction writer named Charles Dickens. Every year, about January, February, we're liable to get snow and severe frosts, such as we've been having for the past fortnight and more this year. And nearly every year, like this year, owing to our national habit of building our houses with the plumbing on the outside, the pipes freeze up, and when the thaw comes, they burst. Every year, because a good many of us invariably forget to put antifreeze in the radiators of our automobiles, we crack our radiators. Every year, because very few of our automobiles are fitted with demisters, our windscreens freeze up. Every year, about this time, because nearly all of us forget to buy any chains, the roads of Britain are littered with abandoned ice-bound vehicles. Every year, owing to the inefficiency of our central heating and the construction of windows which don't resist draft, we shiver with cold in our offices and our homes. The trains run late, the distribution of goods is dislocated, people get snowbound, and we lose hundreds of thousands of man-hours through cold weather illness. I make no excuses. As a nation, it serves us darn well right. But believe me, it is cold over here in England now. Perhaps a little colder this year than even we English deserve. Quite apart from our own national improvidence in preparing for the winter, this year, on top of all that, we are shivering for other reasons outside our own control. We're still struggling to recover from the fuel shortage which came with the war. We're still not producing enough coal to go round. The coal miners, since they were nationalised, have already put up the production figures appreciably. But there aren't enough miners. We're still terribly short of mining machinery replacements, and our transport system hasn't yet recovered from the wear and tear of the war sufficiently to handle the stocks of coal we have got as efficiently as we might. So what's happening in the great freeze of 1947 is that an extra demand has been created for fuel for heat, light and power, which the furnaces haven't got the stocks to supply. The central heating, what we've got of it, is lukewarm. Coal gas for cooking has been reduced to a trickle. Electricity for street lighting has been cut in some areas to semi-blackout conditions. And in our homes at regular intervals, the supply of power has been cut off altogether in an attempt to conserve stocks. I know it's un-British to complain, wrote one cold Londoner this week in a patriotic letter to her favourite newspaper. But I do complain, she said. With a great deal of trouble and work, she wrote, I've equipped my home with all modern conveniences. Running hot and cold water, electric fires, gas water heaters, and all the rest. Yet now that the cold weather's come, I must live by candlelight at a temperature just above freezing point without water, gas, or electricity. That complaint might have been made this week by any one of millions of chilly Britishers. One of the popular theories here in England about our winters is that they're not as cold as they used to be. The reason for the theory is probably because for hundreds of years, English people, and Londoners in particular, always estimated the severity of the winter by whether or not the Thames froze over. In the old days, according to the records, the Thames used to freeze solid about once every 30 years. And the traditional custom when that happened was to have a frost fair, as it was called, and roast an ox on the ice. The last time a frost fair was held was in 1814, well over 100 years ago. So English people argue that the climate is improving and continue to build houses with the plumbing outside to freeze us every winter. And it'd probably wake our ideas up if the Thames did freeze again. But it's thought there's not much chance of it. Not because the winters are milder, but because owing to the removal of old London Bridge, the Thames is now a faster flowing river. It's thought that what caused the great freeze-ups in the old days was that the ice got blocked round the small arches of old London Bridge and slowed the flow of the river. Anyhow, it is a fact that the Thames hasn't frozen over since old London Bridge was falling down. But on the other hand, it's also true that in living memory, no freeze-up of this sort has ever lasted into March, which, according to the old weather records, was what happened when the Thames froze in 1814. They were cooking oxen on it up to March the 20th. That happens this year. We won't have an ox, and by March the 20th, we won't have anything to cook it with. But I don't want to leave you with an impression of blue-nosed, half-starved Londoners shivering over lukewarm pipes and guttering fires. What I've been telling you is the accompaniment of our lives at present, but it isn't the tune. We aren't so cold that the great sculptor Jacob Epstein hasn't been able to make a lot of people hot under the collar with the showing of some of his new creations in London this week. We haven't been so blue with cold that the international cricket match hasn't excited us. The match that England is playing this week against Australia in equatorial weather conditions on the other side of the world. Millions of people are still filling up football pools in the hope of winning enormous money prizes. Perhaps you haven't heard about football pools or Jacob Epstein. They're both British national institutions, and I'm not sure which of them, the football pools or the sculptor, arouse a more popular following in Britain or more controversy. Epstein, who's showing some of his latest work in London this week, has a most peculiar position in British life. Years ago, Epstein aroused a great deal of artistic controversy and collected what, as a serious artist, he must have regarded as an unwelcome notoriety with some monumental and strangely shaped pieces of sculpture. They weren't any more unusual than, say, the work of that other English sculptor, Henry Moore, who's been showing in New York recently. But perhaps Epstein came a little before his time, or he worked bigger, or there was something about his personality that attracted attention. Whatever it was, the popular papers made an event of every new work he did. Various people threw fat on the fire by making protests, and on one occasion, tarring and feathering one of his publicly exhibited carvings. And in the end, one of his most important works was purchased for an enormous sum of money by a funfair proprietor who exhibited it as a horrific sideshow at 10 cents a time. Since then, millions of people who normally have no interest in art at all, millions of people have paid their money to gape at Epstein's work. This new exhibition, opened this week, has had almost as much publicity as a new feature picture. But this time, Epstein is determined to keep his work out of the circus. I saw the new exhibits today. Most of them are studies in bronze of a Negro woman who's Epstein's latest model. They're all very realistic. So realistic that I'm afraid poor Epstein is likely to get in as much trouble about them as he formerly did over his impressionistic work. But he must be hardened to them by this time. What might have been the best work, a bust of Winston Churchill, is curiously enough not up to Epstein's best standard. Seems to have missed something of the rugged power of Churchill's old face. There's nothing in this exhibition like the Adam, the Genesis, and the Lucifer works of past years. But I think Epstein once again demonstrates that he's one of the most brilliant sculptors, if not the most brilliant sculptor of our time. I can only tell you briefly about the football pools now, but I'd like to say something because they're very much in the news over here, and as millions of people fill up the forms every week, they're very much in our minds. The football pools are a form of gambling based on guessing the results of the league matches in our national winter game of association football, what we call soccer. Various pool organizations send out forms which can be filled up in various ways, in which for a small or large stake, people guess whether the results of a series of Saturday football matches will be win, draw, or lose. The stakes are pooled, and people who get the results right divide all the money sent in, less the profits and expenses of the pool organizers. And the pools have become so big, so many millions of people go in for them every week, that prizes of tens of thousands of dollars are a weekly commonplace. The pools themselves are very honestly and efficiently run. There's no evidence at all of corruption. What's causing concern among thoughtful people is the grip which this sort of gambling is getting on the great mass of people in Britain. Working people with small incomes are investing a disproportionate amount of their wages and wasting hours every week filling up forms. The pools organizations themselves are drawing heavily on our already dangerously low manpower to provide the enormous clerical staffs which are necessary to run the things. But the fever doesn't decrease, it grows. Work people using increases in wages are using increases in wages to gamble on the millions to one chance of getting a tax-free fortune. And apart from moral considerations, the government is concerned to divert this wasteful expenditure. It's said that there are plans to put a betting tax on all forms of gambling, including these pools. But it's very difficult to find a satisfactory taxation principle. And many people feel that to tax gambling is to encourage it by giving it official recognition. And in modern times, Britain has always refused to consider anything that savoured of a state lottery. It would seem that the easiest solution would be to make football pools illegal. And indeed, an attempt to check them was actually tried several years ago when the pool organisations were prevented from publishing their coupons in the advertisement columns of the daily papers. The only effect of that was to create a further drain on manpower through the enlistment of thousands of extra girls by the pools organizations to handle the purely mail order business. The government would like to stop football pools tomorrow, but it would require a lot of courage from any government, especially a Labour government relying largely on the votes of working class people. It would need a lot of courage to forbid the most popular national recreation, which regrettably is just about what the football pools now are in Britain. Still, the situation can't be left as it is, and I'm sure that I shall be talking to you about football pools again. Anyhow, before the Thames freezes. And now, this is MacDonald Hastings signing off from London.
That was MacDonald Hastings speaking in the series London Letter.